Thank you. Well, it's a great pleasure for me to have this opportunity to visit this beautiful campus and talk with scientists here and see this nice building and so on. I've been asked to talk about something that's maybe a little bit unusual for this kind of meeting, what I would call maybe the sociology of science, as I have seen it. I'm going to talk about the development of the laser and the maser and the laser and so on, and of course there's science in it, but primarily we'll talk about how things happen and new discoveries. Now, one immediate question is the laser is more famous. There was no principle involved in the laser that wasn't known many years ago, back in the 20s at least. Why did we get the laser long before this? The laser had to come along in the late 50s. Why wasn't it found 30 years earlier? For goodness sake, everybody understood these things? Or did they? Or maybe? Certainly somebody understood every part of it. And I'll try to indicate what some of our problems are in discovering new things. Einstein, of course, well, first let me say what a maser and a laser is in case you don't know exactly what the acronym is. The laser stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. As the light stimulates molecules or atoms that have excess energy to give up the energy to give it to the light. It amplifies. There's no real difference between the maser and the laser. The maser came along first. That was a microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And masers and lasers differ only in wavelength, and that wavelength separation is at 1 millimeter. 1 millimeter, from there, 1 millimeter and longer, that's microwave. 1 millimeter and shorter, people call that light, even though it's infrared for quite a while. In fact, my students wanted to name one of these things eraser. Infrared. But the laser is what stuck. Now, Einstein recognized stimulated emission back in 1917, wrote a paper about it, and this was sort of a discovery. That idea was known, certainly. 1924, Richard Tolman wrote a book in which he talked about absorption of light by molecules and atoms, and he said, well, you have an upper state and a lower state, and there's some atoms and molecules in the upper state, more of them in the lower state, so the light comes along. The atoms are given energy, most of them, but some of them give the energy back to the light. That was known, and he said, well, you know, if there were more in the upper state than in the lower state, we'd have negative absorption. But he went on to say, well, it'd probably be rather small, and that was it. But he recognized, yes, there's negative absorption. Now, even a few years later, he said, well, stimulated emission, nobody had really proved that stimulated emission was coherent, that is exactly in phase with the stimulating radiation. But he said it is pretty obvious it has to be, but nobody's proved it. So he understood that too. And then back in the 30s, there were at least a couple more people who kind of played around with the idea of getting stimulated emission. But nothing happened, and that was that. Actually, this field grew out of microwave spectroscopy of molecules. The whole thing grew out of microwave spectroscopy of molecules. Now, what kind of research director in trying to produce a bright light would say, well, let me get somebody to start work on microwave spectra of molecules, and that's going to give us a bright light? Hardly. And that's all part of science, you know. Things come from surprising places. Let's look a little bit at what the lasers actually do for us. Well, they give us, of course, a beam of light, very coherent beam of light, varying anywhere from much less than a milliwatt of power, small lasers, to up to 10 to the 15th watts, a petawatt, so-called. 10 to the 15th watts. Now, that's more power than we use in the United States. Everybody. Of course, you can't have it on for very long. be too costly. In fact, it's a pulse of about 10 to the minus 12 seconds. But during that 10 to the minus 12 seconds, you've got power of 10 to the 15th watts. Now, people have claimed, but we can go further than that, probably another factor of a million or something like that, and up to what's called a zettawatt, I believe. Anybody familiar with those terminologies these days? Now, that 10 to the 15th watts also can be focused to an area smaller in diameter than the wavelength of light, about the wavelength of light. So that's 10 minus 8 square centimeters. Well, you have 10 to the 23rd watts per square centimeter of power. That puts us in a completely different realm from where we had been otherwise. Now, in addition, one can get very, very short pulses. I mentioned 10 to the minus 12. Well, we can get shorter than that. Get down about 10 to the minus 14, a little bit shorter pulses. The pulse length, depending on the wavelength, and of course, you can't get much shorter than the wavelength. Other things that it does is it gives us very, very precise timing. Very precise timing. The measure gives a precision of about a part in 10 to the 15th in just a few seconds time, in measurement of time. Actually, a cesium beam is our standard of time, but it doesn't do much better than that. Cesium beam is a little more constant over a long time, but otherwise just comparable to a measure. Measure is very, very pure frequency, very, very precise timing. And with these precise frequencies, a lot of good physics has been done in measuring hydrogen transitions, measuring the Rydberg constant more accurately, and so on. We also actually have a Mayser clock. Mayser clocks that run, and those are used in the GPI system. We measure very short times. We measure distances very accurately. Measure distances to a small fraction of wavelength, but there's several kinds of ways in which distance are measured. People have sent a short pulse to the moon, have a reflector up there, let it come back again, so we can measure the distance to the moon to about an inch. Do better than that if we try a little harder. That's a pretty good accuracy, but the most fantastic accuracy that people have been seeking for might be illustrated by the LIGO. This is an instrument being built at Caltech, by Caltech and others, to try to measure gravitational waves. And they are getting an accuracy of about a one part in 10 to the 21st in a distance of about 4 kilometers. That means in 4 kilometers, they're trying to measure to an accuracy of about 4 times 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. In other words, about 100 millionth of the size of an atom. That's the kind of precision that they are approximately getting. And they'd like to get another factor of 10 or so to measure the gravitational waves. Now, in addition, it gives a very perfect kind of amplification. The Mayser, when it was invented, was the most sensitive amplifier we had, about 100 times more sensitive than the electronic amplifiers of the day. How sensitive? Well, quantum mechanics says if you have an amplifier which can amplify a wave, thereby it can measure the phase of the wave, and the uncertainty principle says, well, there must be some noise there. The amount of noise, if you can measure the phase, the amount of noise has to be 1 quantum per unit bandwidth per time, per unit time. And so there is noise, but that noise, and the Mayser can get down to do amplification with only that limited amount of noise. In the microwave region, let's say at 1 centimeter wavelength, that corresponds to a noise temperature of about 1.4 degrees. Previously, we were up around, well, maybe we'd get half a room temperature, let's say, for the noise temperature before. Now, it's interesting that when that came along, that was very exciting, and I even used it to do some radio astronomy, and other people were. But Walter Heger came around to me one day. He was from out here, and he said, well, now, I've seen your theory of the noise and Mayser's. I'm wondering, won't a parametric amplifier do the same thing? I said, wait a minute. Hey, that's right. Parametric amplifier will. See, the noise in the amplifiers at the time would do the fact that we're using electrons, and electrons had charges and that produced noise. Parametric amplifier is where you have a non-linearity in solid material, anything else, and you can let waves interact and you amplify. Hey, that's right. And so parametric amplifiers are now the most useful most useful, really very good amplifiers. Mesas will do a little bit better, but in principle, parametric amplifiers can also do that. Well, now we also get into a new realm of optics. The very intense light that we achieve can produce nonlinearity. We can get the second harmonic and get the third harmonic, the fourth harmonic, and so on, of the light wave that we send into the material. The light is very intense, but we can make such a short pulse, we can send a short pulse of fantastically intense light, it doesn't overheat or hurt the material very much. So the material can just stay constant. We send a short pulse, we can get harmonics out. We can mix waves and get addition and subtraction of frequencies and so on. And a very wide variety of nonlinear optics, that's opened up a new field of optics. The fact that one can do that, get nonlinearities, which pulses are so short they don't overheat, is also important. For example, it's being used now as a way of testing characteristics of blood cells without destroying the blood cells. You get nonlinearities without destroying the blood cells. Lasers also used for cooling down to the lowest possible temperatures. Fantastically intense energies they use for cooling. And they have succeeded in cooling materials down to 10 to the minus 6 a millionth of 1 degree absolute. And some of you know wonderful work in low temperature physics that's been done using lasers for cooling. Who would have thought that bright lights would cool again? Well, let's look at some of the. Perhaps I ought to mention also that after we discovered masers and lasers on the Earth, we found out they're up there in space. They're naturally occurring things. They've been there for billions of years. There are about 100 different kinds of masers that have been found in interstellar space. Molecules or atoms amplifying up there, sending us fairly intense beams. There are also some lasers. Now, lasers are a little hard to get in interstellar space because the high frequency means that it's harder to get that much excitation for a long time. But we have lasers up there, natural lasers, at wavelengths down to about 1 micron. That is certainly getting right into the optical range. And as I say, they've been there for billions of years. We had plenty of sensitivity to detect those. If we just looked with a good antenna, we could have detected them back in the 30s. Had these intense waves coming in, and people said, what in the world is that? What can it be? They probably would have figured it out, and then would have figured out how to do it on Earth, too. But we didn't bother to look, of course. Let's look at some of the applications. Now, communications is one of the big applications of lasers, as you know, fiber optics. And on one fiber and one optical beam, you can put 10 to the 11th hertz bandwidth. That's about 10 to the 11th bits of information per second. That's just enormously larger than anything we've had before. It's so large, and people got so enthusiastic about it that they overbuilt, and the result is the companies who run into fiber optics are having a hard time right now. We've got too much. Now it's also very useful for information recording and readout. You know, of computers, you can record things and read it out with modulated little fine little beam of lasers. Masers are used for the GPI, position measuring. Surveying is another thing. You take a beam of light, you cross-establish a straight line, but you can also reflect it back and measure the distance very exactly. So it's just automatically good for surveying. It cuts and welds with that much energy, you can cut anything. You can cut and make a hole in diamond or anything else very easily. You can cut and weld big things. It's being used in sizable, very substantial manufacturing, but you can also cut very, very small things. You cut tiny little grooves, a hole, or you can evaporate, clean something off a surface, evaporate it, you can have a pulse of energy, very intense. It immediately evaporates the surface without even heating the under the surface. The surface can stay pretty cool and evaporate things off. That's being used to take things off the skin, for example, and medical work and so on. And there are many medical applications. One of the first is for detached retina. Now, in the very early days, I wrote a paper with a doctor who wanted to see what could be done in the medical field with lasers, and we tried to imagine what could be done. We didn't say anything about detached retina. I'd never heard of a detached retina. He didn't mention it to me. But that's one of the first and very important uses. You shine a laser beam in the eye and you can reattach the retina. You don't have to cut anything. You just don't feel anything hardly. There are many other ways. Many other things have been used, being used on teeth, being used on skin, used for operations and so on. Okay, now, why didn't it come along sooner? Well, look at the history. It's clear it came out of microwave spectroscopy of molecules, because there were three independent groups that sort of co-invented this kind of operation, the maser at least. There's myself at Columbia University. I was doing microwave spectroscopy. I was involved in radar during the war, and some of the radar was troubled by absorption of a water vapor coming through the atmosphere. And I studied that, and I recognized, hey, there's a very interesting field of microwave spectroscopy molecules to be done here. And Bell Labs let me do that after the war. And there were a number of other laboratories that started work on that. But the other laboratories that helped invent this were Bashoff and Prokhorov in Russia, and then Joe Weber at the University of Maryland. And they all had more or less independent ideas. Some went further than others, but they were independent ideas that, hey, this might be done. We might get amplification. So why the delay? Well, one is that we channel our thoughts. Science is great in telling us, well, you know, let's take a look at these general principles now, and especially a new general principle we're excited about, and it's interesting. We think of that, and we always sort of think in those terms, and we don't necessarily think of the alternatives. Our intuitions are all guided along this particular road, you see. For example, when I was at Bell Laboratories, I wanted to persuade them to let me do microwave spectroscopy. I had to persuade them it might have some use somehow. And I explained that it might have some use. For example, it could absorb energy. It could act like a resistor. It could act like a capacitance or inductance. It could change phases. But I was careful to point out, and I was very proud of myself to admit this and point it out, that you couldn't get much energy from the molecules. You couldn't get an oscillator because thermodynamics says to get high intensity of radiation, you've got to warm the material up. You have to warm the molecules up so much that they'd fall apart to get any appreciable microwave energy. And I recognize that general principle, you see, and I was proud to be able to use general principle and recognize that. Well, no question, you can't get energy, and I wrote this memorandum pointing that out to them. They let me do it, nevertheless. That was part of my own blindness. Now, furthermore, after the war, I got a job pretty soon at Bell Labs, let me work on it, but most of the other industries shut it down. Actually, it started up in industry because they all had microwave equipment. There was microwave spectroscopy at General Electric, at RCA, at Westinghouse, and at Bell Labs. General Electric, Westinghouse, RCA shut it down. And my friends were working there, said, oh, it's too bad. It's very interesting science. But my company says, well, there's just nothing that will be applicable for us, and we've got to do something that's going to make some money. So you've got to do something else. Well, Bell Labs was generous enough, and I was persuasive enough that they let me continue to work. And I did some good physics, and then I got a job at Columbia University where people were really interested in the physics of it, and continued there. I wanted very much to get down to shorter wavelengths, because as we moved from the microwave region, which is in the centimeter region, I was working at 1, 2 centimeters and a half a centimeter, we had oscillators, magnetrons, for example, and klystrons that could get down to 2 or 3 millimeters wavelength, which was doing pretty well. I'd like to get higher than that. I wanted to get on down into the infrared, below a millimeter anyhow. And I worked at it, and my students worked at it, and we had some ideas, and they sort of worked some, but they weren't very good. For several years, I kept thinking about how can we do this, and then I was even appointed on a committee by the Navy. I was asked to be chair a committee and put together the committee to try to study how one could get down into the millimeter range at least, and maybe beyond, how one could do that. And we visited all the laboratories around, and we talked among ourselves. We had engineers and physicists and chemists and what to do. And after we had a number of meetings, I was getting a little frustrated. We hadn't found anything. Our last meeting was in Washington, D.C., and I was in the hotel. I wake up early one morning and said, "Mike, we just haven't been able to do this." And I went out and sat on the bench in the park, and now, you know, we've looked at this and looked at this. And the trouble is, to get short wavelengths, you'd have to make a resonant cavity of some kind, short as a wavelength, or roughly a short wavelength, like a millimeter. Well, we get down a millimeter maybe with a little cavity. But then you've got to put enough energy in it for it to provide energy and oscillate, and that was difficult. So getting below a millimeter just didn't seem practical to anybody. Why can't we do this? I said, "Well, now, of course, molecules oscillate at much shorter wavelengths, hey, but we can't get power out of them because of thermodynamics." I said, "Now, wait a minute. Thermodynamics doesn't have to apply. Hey, we don't have to have thermal equilibrium. We can get molecules that are mostly in an upper state." I had just heard a talk by a German physicist, Powell, on a new way of getting intense molecular beams, in which he had a quadrupole focuser, that is four bars with electric fields between them, send a beam of molecules, and this would separate out upper states from lower states. He just talked about that at Columbia in a colloquium, and I remember the numbers well enough, and I quickly pulled out an envelope and wrote down some, let's see, can we get enough molecules to get a cavity to oscillate? Hey, it looks like it probably can be done. Wow. Well, I was all excited, and well, I went back to my hotel room, and Art Shallow, with a postdoc with me, happened to be staying in the same hotel at another meeting he was going to, and I talked with him. "Oh, yeah," he said, "well, you know, that might work." And I didn't mention it to the rest of our committee because I thought, well, I'd better think about this a little bit, just to be sure. And I went back to Columbia, and I thought about it some more, and I wrote it down carefully. It looks like it could work. And after 2 or 3 months, I got a student, a very good student, Jim Gordon, who had worked with molecular beams, and he was willing to give it a try. Okay, so he tried it. And I got a postdoc. Somebody provided me money with a postdoc, and Herb Seiger started working on it too. So we worked on it. Now, here's where our habits of thought come in very prominently. Most people in the Department of Physics knew that I was working on this, and it was completely open. A lot of my friends would come by and say, "What you're doing?" Oh, I'd show them this thing we were trying to do to make a major oscillator. "Oh, yeah, well, that's kind of interesting." And nobody was competing. Nobody was interested enough to try to compete. Nobody thought, "Well, yeah, okay, that's kind of a nice idea." But on the other hand, some of the theoretical physicists didn't believe it. L.H. Thomas, who you may have heard of, the Thomas effect, he was a professor at Columbia then, as well as in IBM, and he came over to Columbia frequently. He'd meet me in the hallway and said, "Charlie, that's not right. You just don't understand." Well, I'm trying to find out from just what the trouble was. I could never get exactly understand what his problem was. He said, "No, you just don't understand." And well, I checked it out. I had had notes from my Caltech graduate work under W.B. Houston on notes on quantum mechanics and the interaction of electromagnetic waves. I looked at that carefully. And one of the things, of course, people question, well, would the amplification really be coherent? Well, now you see, if you're molecular, in microwave spectroscopy, you know the following. You have an upper level and a lower level. The microwave energy corresponds about 1 degree absolute. And so the relative population of the two states are almost equal. Only 1% difference in the population. As a wave goes through, the molecules in lower state absorb a quantum and hop up here. Okay, we know all about that. Of course, they absorb a quantum. The quantum is there, just the same frequency. But now the ones up here will emit a quantum and fall down, and they give it to the wave. Well, we know a wave going through an absorbing gas doesn't change its frequency. Change its phase change its phase just to index of refraction, but otherwise it's all coherent. So here are these molecules flipping back and forth hundreds of times. When you get 10% absorption, you've had 1,000 times that in emission, and obviously it's in phase. But again, it was counterintuitive to many people. And now, Professor Robbie and Professor Kirschwin in the department, they were molecular beamists. And I was lucky I was in the department of molecular beams because I knew how to do molecular beams. And that's one reason I tried sending a beam of molecules, excited molecules, into a cavity. Let them give energy in the cavity, and the feedback from the cavity then got more energy from them. So we would hope to get an oscillation. Jim Gordon was trying hard to make this work. And we've been working on it for a couple of years. Robbie and Kush, Robbie had been chairman of the department, Kush was then chairman of the department. They came to my office and sat down and said, you know, look, Charlie, that's not going to work. You know it's not going to work. We know it's not going to work. You're really wasting the department's money. And you've got to stop. Well, here is the advantage of tenure. I was an associate professor, so I had tenure. And I looked at him, I said, well, no, I think it has a reasonable chance and I'm going to keep going. Well, they marched out of my office kind of annoyed. And about 3 months after that, Jim Gordon dashed into my seminar and said, it's working. So we all left the classroom, went to the laboratory to see, and sure enough, it was working. All the numbers said, yes, it ought to work. We just have to keep doing it, making it a little bit better and a little bit better, and then it's going to work. And sure enough, it did. The physics was all there. But it was counterinstinctive to so many people. After it was working, I happened to be walking along the street in Denmark with Niels Bohr. I knew Ole Bohr, his son, who had been at Columbia and was visiting over there. I was walking along the street, and Niels Bohr asked me what I was doing. Of course, that's a natural thing, one physicist asks another. And so I said, well, you know, we've just made this thing we call a measure, and this is what it does. It gives a very pure frequency and so on. And he looked at me and said, no, that can't be right. I said, well, yes, so it's working. No, you must misunderstand somehow. That can't be right. Now, I'm sure what he was thinking of is the uncertainty principle. You see, if you measure a frequency of a molecule in a finite time, it's got to have a bandwidth. It can't be a pure frequency. And these molecules are going through a cavity. They were going through a cavity and they were absorbing or losing energy in a finite time. They had to have a finite bandwidth, obviously. The uncertainty principle obviously is in Niels Bohr's mind, as it was in a lot of theoretical physicists. Well, I said, no, it's working. And I said, well, maybe you're right. And I don't think he was very convinced, but he stopped arguing with me anyhow. A little later, I was at a cocktail party at Princeton University and ran into John von Neumann. And he again said, well, what are you doing these days? Oh, well, I told him about the measure. Oh, no, you must be misunderstanding. That can't be right. And I said, no, yes, it is, and it's working, and this is why. No, it's something wrong, something you don't understand there. It's just different. And he went off to get another drink. And about 15 minutes, he came back and said, you're right. He had thought it through again, you see. His instincts, well, no, you can't do that. You can't have such a definite frequency. And then he sat down and said, you know, tell me, have you ever thought about doing this with a semiconductor, exciting the electrons in a semiconductor and getting amplification that way? And I said, well, yes, that'd be a good thing to do, but I don't know any semiconductors that are just right, and I don't know just how to do it, but it'd be a good thing to do. And I was kind of puzzled he'd bring this up. A few years later, I found out why. He was being modest, because he had done a lot of work thinking about neutrons coming out of a pile, hitting a semiconductor and exciting the electrons, which would then give very intense light. A way of getting a dense light source to excite electrons with neutrons from a pile, and he had worked it all out. He'd sent a letter to Teller, Edward Teller, saying, don't you think we ought to try to do this? Teller never bothered to answer. And he then dropped the subject. But you see, he had kind of invented it too, but he didn't realize it was coherence. He didn't think about the coherence, and the coherence was a large part of the point. Now, in fact, the whole field needed a kind of combination of quantum mechanics, of physicists, and electrical engineering. Electrical engineers in that period didn't know much quantum mechanics. They had never heard of spontaneous emission. I mean, never heard of stimulated emission. The physicists didn't think much about feedback and feedback oscillators and so on. They weren't very much concerned with those. Well, I was working in engineering during World War II. I and these other people had picked up some engineering. We had that point of view. Now, an engineer, if you tell an engineer you've got a feedback oscillator, he said, well, of course, it'll be very narrow band. A feedback oscillator, of course. Get enough feedback, that'll be very narrow band. And the engineer was obvious. What they didn't know was stimulated emission. And I remember telling John Pierce, a very famous electrical engineer at Bell Labs, about this, and well, you have application then. And if and then on, he could understand it. But the physicist's intuition didn't work like that of the engineers. Now, another problem, which is not uncommon, is in a new field, people don't recognize the possible value of the field. Nobody wanted to compete with me or bother to try to build a measure. Some people believe it, particularly other people close to my field. They believe, yeah, something like that might work, but, well, what's the point in it? After we got the first one working, it became very popular then. And after one or two years, everybody was sending in papers on laser, and so many that Sam Goldschmidt, the editor of the Physical Review of Letters, put an announcement in the Physical Review of Letters, I'm not going to publish any more papers about masers. We've been too familiar with masers. No more papers about masers will be published. I don't think that's ever happened before. Well, I went on sabbatical. I thought it was time to try to get some new ideas, and I went on sabbatical, and I went to France, but I ran into a former student of mine there who was working on electron spins, where you can flip the spin from up to down the magnetic field and you get an energy difference. Ah, well, I thought about that already before, but here he had an electron spin that would stay up for a long time, and that means it could be used as an amplifier, because a wave comes along, stimulates it, falls down, and gives the energy. Furthermore, that frequency can be tuned by changing the magnetic field. So here was a tunable measure possibility. So, oh, let's work on that. Would you like to work? Well, he sure, he did. So he and another French person and I worked on it a bit, and we sort of got it working in about 3 months, and I had to go in Japan. Well, about that same time, there was a physicist, Strandberg, at MIT, a good friend of mine. He was also in microwave spectroscopy molecules. And of course, he knew about the maser by then, and he thought about doing it with electron spins. And he gave a talk in a seminar, maybe like this. He was giving a talk about possibility of using electron spins and getting them to amplify. And Professor Bloombergen, Nico Bloombergen from Harvard, was sitting in the back of the audience. And after the talk, he came up to Strandberg and said, well, you know, why would you want to do that? And Strandberg said, oh, that gives the most sensitive amplifier we've ever had, if we can do it. Oh, uh-huh. So he went back to Harvard. Now, Bloombergen had been working on electron spins in solids in ways which I didn't know at that time very well, where the energies can be unevenly spaced, so-called three-level electron spin levels in a solid, in a crystal. He'd been working on those anyhow. So he invented really the right way to do it. Namely, a three-level measure. You have three levels, and you have some pumping energy that brings the electron from here to here, and then it amplifies and falling from there to there. It gives up energy falling from there to there. The three-level electron measure amplifier, and that was the best one for quite a while. But you see different physicists contributing different things, and that's an important part of the picture, and suggesting things to each other. Now, I went on to Japan as part of my sabbatical, and there I ran into somebody just walking along the street in Tokyo. Somebody I recognized, hey, you're a biologist from Columbia, my own university. And I got up to him and said, hey, well, what are you doing? Oh, I'm on sabbatical. Well, that's funny, I'm on sabbatical too. Well, what are you working on? Oh, says, well, I'm looking at the fluctuations in the population of a microorganism colony. Oh, I said, well, you take a group of microorganisms, and one will die, and that gets rid of it, but others will multiply, and that doubles the number, and now A mathematician in Great Britain had worked out how the total population will fluctuate as a result of dying and multiplying in combination, discrete. I said, wait a minute, that's just like molecules. Look, you see, if we have absorption of a photon by a molecule, that's a photon dying. If we have stimulated emission, that's a photon doubling itself. Now we just have to add one more term, spontaneous emission, where the photon is created by the molecule falling spontaneously. Where's that paper? Oh, he told me where the paper was, and I got it. Well, there's some mathematical equations there showing the fluctuation. I wanted very much to get a very precise picture of the fluctuations in the measure and the amplification and the oscillation and so on. I knew roughly what it was, but I wanted to get a good picture of it. Well, I was at lunch with some of my Japanese friends, and I was having trouble with this equation. And one of them was an applied mathematician, and he pitched in. And so the Shimoda and Takahashi and I then wrote a paper and solved this then with the extra term in it to get exactly what the fluctuations are like. That comes out of biology, you see, of all things. But actually, the theoretician who had done this biological work, he was a theoretical chemist in Great Britain, too. Lasers were a hot topic for some time, and I was interested in them, working on them, and trying to build better ones and so on, and it was good fun. But what I really wanted is to get to shorter wavelengths. I kept hoping I'd have a good idea, like the one I had sitting on the bench, and now I just never had a good idea, and it seemed hard to get these down to shorter wavelengths. I'd have to build very small cavities and then somehow excite molecules with much more energy. And all the people working in masers, essentially none of them thought that you'd get much shorter wavelengths. It was discussed a little bit, and people said, well, no, you know, they'll fall down from the upper state too fast. You can't, it's not going to be practical much shorter wavelengths. But that's what I wanted to do spectroscopy with it. My primary aim was to get a good tool for spectroscopy that would oscillate very pure frequencies down into the infrared. And now, I thought that probably we ought to be able to get at least another factor of 10, maybe, down into the infrared. Summer of 1957, I was asked to be on a committee, on a group of people for the Air Force, to make a study of what is the new technology going to be over the next 25 years of particular interest to the Air Force. What kind of new technology should the Air Force support? What kind of things might be coming along the next 25 years? Well, I was on an electronics committee, and so we talked about various electronics devices. And when we wrote our report, I put in there, one ought to push on the maser and try to get it to shorter wavelengths. Maybe it could get down as far as the mid-infrared. And that was in our report, but that's something that might be done in a few decades. That report was given to the Air Force. Now, at the same time that summer, the Air Force told us, look, please don't say too much about anything in space, about satellites or anything, because Congress is dead set against that. They think we just might be playing around up there and wasting a lot of money. And don't say too much about that. So the report didn't have very much about space. In the summer of 57, the fall of 57, Sputnik went up. Congress completely changed its mind. Sputnik went up. Everybody thought, well, we must get into space. We must do this. We can't let the Russians get ahead of us. We must do this and that. So the Air Force held its report. And said, well, let's not issue this. We better have it revised, and we'll do it. We'll have another study next summer. So we had another study summer of 58. I thought, well, I'd had enough of it, and I didn't go. And so they wrote a new report, put in a lot of space work. They took out anything having to do with pushing the maser down to shorter wavelengths. After all, that was just this crazy guy Towns that thought that could be done. And so they took that out as any of the future technology for the Air Force. And so the report was issued, and I didn't know it until after the report was issued. But in the meantime, already I had found out how to do it. It was in late 57, after that first Air Force meeting, I said, well, gee, I just we've got to get the shorter wavelengths. Now, I'm just going to sit down and see what's the best way I can think of. I don't have any bright ideas. I'll see what's the best way I can think of doing it. So I wrote down all the equations of what was necessary, and I said, no, hey, no, wait a minute. Wait, no, it looks like actually it's not all that much harder to get down to visible wavelengths, not just into the infrared, to get down to visible wavelengths even. That's what the equations were saying, and everybody's intuition had been otherwise. God knows you can't get much shorter wavelengths. Not only can you get shorter wavelengths, you can get down into visible. I needed a cavity, but I said, well, okay, let's just make a big cavity. Make a big box like this, and the waves will be reflected back and forth. I won't get a single mode, unfortunately, at least not easily. But clearly I can excite enough atoms in here by sending in some light and exciting them, and we can get oscillations, even down to light waves. Well, I was consultant at Bell Labs at that time, and my job was to just go talk with people at Bell Labs and go out there one day every couple of weeks and talk to them. Well, that was kind of fun. I was glad to do that. And so I was walking around and stopped in to see my brother-in-law, Art Charlo, who was at Bell Labs then. And I told him, well, you know, I think masers can be pushed on down right onto optical wavelengths. And he said, well, you know, I've been wondering about that. I'm very interested in that. And I said, well, let's work on it together. So we did. And he had the idea of taking two parallel mirrors. Now, why did I miss that? I know all about mirrors, I thought. Two parallel mirrors as a cavity. And the wave can go back and forth, and any wave that doesn't go straight back and forth is going to get lost, so you can pick out a particular mode. It has to oscillate in a particular mode. So he was the one who had added that idea. So we wrote a paper on it. Now, because it was Bell Labs, I thought, well, they should own the patent, I guess. I was consulting with them, and they should own the patent. Well, we have to put it through their patent department, and we couldn't say anything about it to anybody outside of their labs. It had to be a secret. So that was the fall of 57, and we began writing the paper and so on. This Air Force report, which shut it out, was written in the summer of 58. Our paper actually was just come out because we had finished it. Bell Labs had patented it properly by about June in 58. But the people in that study just hadn't seen it. It was circulating around privately, and everybody then got excited. Now, during all that time, essentially nobody said, well, let's try to get down to optical wavelengths. Nobody bothered. Nobody says, well, it's just out of the question. No, you can't do that. You know, this is a microwave thing, and it's fine. Microwaves can't get down to shorter wavelengths. So nobody had said anything. And when we published the paper, then suddenly there was a big outburst of energy and activity. Because the maser by then had become well known. People recognized its value. And here's a laser. Oh, maybe we can do it at shorter wavelengths, and here's a way of doing it. Then everybody got excited, and a lot of people worked at it. Now, however, it wasn't clear to many people what good it was going to do. And a number of people came up to me and said, well, that's a nice idea, but it's an invention looking for an application. What can it do? Well, I knew various things it could do, communication being one obvious one. And we sold that to Bell Labs immediately, of course, the possibility. We didn't think of fiber optics at that time, but the communication just with the beam was obvious. And to me, it seemed to me to marry optics and electronics, both of which had lots of applications. You marry those two fields, obviously you're going to touch on a lot of different things which you could do. And I could think of some things, but most people say, well, yeah, that's a nice idea, but it's an invention looking for an application. What can you do with it? I might also comment, since we're so close to Caltech, I was visiting Caltech one time, and Dick Feynman asked me what I was doing. He said, well, you know, I like your idea about the laser. You know how you tell what is a good idea? That's if you say, oh, I could have thought of that. That's why you tell a good idea. I could have thought of that. And sure enough, anybody could have. Anybody could have, in a sense, but we were just all oriented in the wrong directions. Well, now, the first maser, actually, about at that point, I took a job down in Washington. I felt Washington badly needed scientists, and I was asked to go down there. I felt kind of a duty, so I spent a couple of years down there. But my students were trying to build a laser, but they weren't the first to do it. It was Ted Maimon at Hughes who built the first laser. He did it with a flash bulb. and Ruby. Now, I hadn't thought about a flash where you can get a lot more intensity. I was thinking of a CW laser. You got a flash bulb, you got the Ruby laser, and that was the first laser. Very soon after that, Sorokin and Stevenson at IBM, they had another kind of solid material in the flash, and they got the second laser going. The third laser was made by Javon at Bell Labs, third laser to get going. That was a continuous laser and a discharge, a helium neon laser. Now, Javon had been my student at Columbia. I hadn't told him anything about this because it's supposed to be secret, you see. But he took a job at Bell Labs, and when he got to Bell Labs, he could learn about it. Oh, then he had a better idea. Oh, you guys trying to excite it with light, that's not so good. Excite it with electric discharge, that's much better. So he worked this all out, and he's a very good guy. And he found the solution, helium neon, and so Bell Labs started building that. And now, I want you to notice how this comes about. You see, the ideas came from universities and from university research. But once it got going, once the industry recognized its importance, they were prepared to put a lot more energy and power in it. And so all of the first lasers were built in industry, but built by people who had studied microwave spectroscopy at a university. Ted Maiman was a student of Willis Lamb, who was with me at Columbia, went out to Stanford doing spectroscopy with radio waves. And Ted Maiman was his student who had done that and then gone to industry. Sorokin was Nico Bloomberg's student, working on microwave spectroscopy. Stevenson was one of my students. So Stevenson and Sorokin made the second one at IBM, you see. They could put full time on it and lots of resources, and they did. And then Javon was another one of my students who worked in microwave spectroscopy, went to Bell Labs. And then one other laser ought to be mentioned. Hall invented the first solid state laser at General Motors. Now, he'd been working in solid state, not in microwaves, but by then the lasers were going around. So you see that this required people educated in the universities with this new kind of science, but going to industry where they get lots of support and help, and all the first ones have been built there. Well, you've heard the story. Now, let me sort of summarize the situation as I see it. Lasers are only one of many breakthroughs and new ideas that have come from science. And each one has a little different history, of course. But I would maintain there are many similarities in really new ideas that change our thoughts and change our orientation. There are many similarities. And I would say one of them is, one thing we should learn from this is that basic research shouldn't be supported simply for the technology that we perceive it's going to contribute. It should be supported as exploration. Exploration to find new things, new ideas and so on, new things, which may have some probability of making completely unexpected contributions. But we don't know that much about it beforehand that we can plan and say, well, let's support this basic research because we know that can pay off. We want to explore, and new things are going to come that way. They're not going to come quite so much from planning. Secondly, interactions can be very fruitful in generating innovative ideas. We learn things from each other. But if we have people interacting in different fields, then they get a new perspective from a different field. You saw the interaction between engineering and physics, interaction with biology, and so on. Chemists, too, have played a very important part in this, and so on. So, thirdly, we have to be open to new viewpoints and accept experiments that don't necessarily fit our standard kind of scientific thinking as to what's important, what's really going to work, and so on. But we've got to be open-minded and even encourage people who are challenging us. To encourage challenges to the standard paradigms. Of course, we have to think hard, are they right? Can they be right? And we don't want to do something that's completely useless that we can prove is absolutely wrong, but we better be careful. Are we really proving it? You see, the uncertainty principle, many people said, prove that you can't get these pure frequencies. To me, thermodynamics proved we couldn't get energy out of molecules and so on. So we need to be careful and open-minded. And finally, I think the sociology of science is very, very important. How people interact, how ideas go around, how many different people contribute. The field of lasers has grown from the whole community. A community builds a field, not an individual. An individual may contribute one idea, but the fields build as a result of a community and the contributions of a community. The importance of a community, I think, is something that we need to emphasize. It's perhaps particularly true today, where we want science to develop rapidly and where there is a large community. Maybe a few hundred years ago, scientists were more isolated. Certainly they corresponded and interacted in an important way. But now we have all kinds of opportunities to interact with many different fields, many different people, and that's sociology, and the contribution that many different people make. An idea here and an idea there, an idea in a completely different field suggests something here, and so on. Those contributions and interactions, I think, are very important. Now, as I see the field, it's still growing. I would say the field of lasers is maybe in the stage of adolescence. It's old enough so that we can see pretty plainly. It's a powerful field, can do a lot of things, but it hasn't done all the things it can do yet. There's still a lot of growth there, and it'll do other things. We can see the potentialities, but it's still, I think, a long way to go. Also, I'll end this way. I look back on the field. I kind of like to compare myself with a beaver. A beaver sitting down in the Grand Canyon by the river, looking up at the enormous Hoover Dam. The Hoover Dam is one of the most beautiful dams there are. It's a concrete dam, a wonderful structure there, an enormous big dam. There's a beaver sitting down there looking at it. And he says to his friend the rabbit, "Well, no, I didn't really build that myself, but it's based on an idea of mine." Want to try a few questions?
Professor Thomas would be willing to take a few questions over here.
He thinks that very beautifully how people were unwilling to believe that it's possible to build a laser. But if I'm not mistaken, you shared Nobel Prize with two other people. So apparently there was some parallel research on the other side of Iron Curtain. Can you comment on that maybe?
Oh yes. Well, as I mentioned, there were three separate sources, three independent sources of the idea. Which in modern times, there were earlier people who had something like the idea, but they didn't really see the potentialities, didn't do anything about it. But it was myself and Basov and Prokhorov in Russia who got the Nobel Prize with me, and then Joe Weber at Maryland. Joe Weber didn't go very far, but he had some of the ideas. And those were three independent sources. Now, all of those people were working in microwave spectroscopy. I would say the people working in microwave spectroscopy were reasonably quick to believe what I was doing made some sense. They initially didn't, most of them didn't think it was necessarily all that important. They didn't try to compete with me at all. But they understood the field, whereas the physicists not working and not having those intuitions connected with electrical engineering, connected with absorption and emission, both from molecule to sea and all of that, people who hadn't had that kind of background didn't have the right intuitions and orientations, whereas people in the field tended to do so. So there were physicists in the field who understood this, I think, pretty well. And as I say, my idea was not unique. There were at least two other independent ideas. But some of them went further than others, but nevertheless, it's clear they had independent ideas. Did that answer your question? Yeah.
Questions?
I'd like to ask, you've seen a science...
Excuse me, last week there was some complaint that people in the back couldn't hear the questions. Could you speak louder? Stand up.
Sorry. I'd just like to ask Dr. Towns, since you watched science develop since essentially before World War II to the present time, do you think that the fact that physicists interacted with engineers at the radiation lab and other places, and therefore understood the importance of application, had an impact on your discovery of the maser and subsequently the laser, and other things that have happened, and are we losing any of that today, or is it in much better shape, if that is a motivating factor today?
You know, the question is interaction during World War II between physicists and engineers, what effect did that have on the understanding of physicists of applications and other things, and what's going on today? Well, I think that interaction was a very, very important one. A lot of physicists learned a lot from it, and I think engineers learned something too. And immediately after World War II, there was an outburst of very important experiments done by physicists that they had envisioned from their training in engineering. People like Purcell, for example, and many experiments in this field. Now, did that make physicists appreciate applications more? I think so, but I think physicists were also very eager to get back to do some research, some fundamental research, because they'd been doing applications for a while, and so in a sense, there was a push to move into basic research and get that done. Nevertheless, to take my own case, sure, I could visualize applications, and I think many other physicists couldn't. I could visualize the applications as a result. I hope that partially answers your question. I think that interaction was very important. Well, I guess another part of the question, are we missing that today? I think we are some. I think we ought to look for ways of having people interact. There during World War II, we had to. We all had to buckle down and get some things done of an engineering type, and we all were working together. We want to continue our basic research, but we want to have interactions. I think universities need to think very carefully of how to help generate those interactions, interdisciplinary interactions. Okay, any other questions?
I guess the IQP may be an example of the research and so on.
Other questions? There's a question over there. I guess it's Phil.
How discouraged were you at any point by a prominent theorist or experimentalist even coming
up? Sorry, I can't quite hear you. Speak.
How discouraged were you at any point by a prominent person such as Moore or someone else saying, you can't do that, it violates the fundamental principles of physics as you know, I understand them. And yet for most people that would be a devastating comment. I mean, of course, we see over and over in history that those things are in fact the breaking points in which we make progress. But did that ever discourage you to the point that you thought the whole thing?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
I think you said that most people would have been discouraged by an authority like Niels Bohr and would have stopped right there. And so perhaps I can amplify the question.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think in theoretical physics, as I know it, I know of many cases in which young people were discouraged by senior people and stopped doing whatever they're doing. So I think that's the question.
Well, okay. Question is, can more senior people discourage you so you don't do the right things? They certainly can. And I think we must be careful in two directions. We want to listen to other people's criticisms. Listen carefully to other people's criticisms and think about them. So can they be right? But also, don't hesitate. If you carefully look at it and think you're right, don't hesitate to believe you're right if you really look at it carefully. We've got to have some resistance to persuasion and just following the herd. If we follow the herd, then all science is sort of going to go in one direction, and we won't get the new thing. So we've got to be stubborn, but we also have to be thoughtful. If we have criticisms are valuable. If you have criticisms, look at them carefully, which I tried to do, and I thought I had the answers. And the only problem was a practical one, whether we could get enough molecules and get the oscillation. But I thought the theory I understood well, and these people just weren't paying enough attention to it, in my view. In any case, yeah, you have to be stubborn, but you also have to be thoughtful and careful.
Can I follow it up with one comment, which is, do you think you ever could have gotten through a review committee had you sent the proposals
to NSF? You're quite right. That's probably right. That's probably quite right. I think review committees are a real problem. in terms of radically original work, because they tend to go along with the herd, and we've got to have ways of supporting. Now, I'll tell you a story about time a congressman who was chairman of the House Committee on Science came to Berkeley to visit. He wanted to meet with some scientists, and he came to Berkeley, and we had lunch with him, and he said to a scientist, said, well, you know, look, you have to understand that we are spending, Congress is spending public money, and we've got to put that money in places that's going to pay off for the American public. We can't just support any research, we've got to put it in places that's going to pay off. Well, I immediately started telling the story of the laser a little bit. I said, look, you can't be sure. Yeah, you want to put it where it's going to pay off, but you can't know for sure. And he listened, and after lunch he said, well, should we have a special fund for crackpot ideas? I said, no, not that. See, that's the problem. That is a problem. It takes a great judgment, but we've got to be open-minded in that judgment. We clearly have to be open-minded.
Perhaps I can amplify also Phil's question a little bit more. Now, you said the young person should be stubborn when discouraged by senior people. But in many cases, that's very difficult because the senior person may be the person writing the letter of recommendation for mm-hmm. the young person's next job. Now, when you were doing this, you said that you already had tenure. Now, was that very early on that you had tenure? Or
yeah, I came to Columbia with tenure.
With tenure.
From Bell Labs. I was senior nothing, and I could be appointed immediately associate professor. So, and this is one reason I took the job.
Right.
I was senior enough that I won tenure.
So what
point.
Is your advice for young people without tenure?
Well, that's a diplomatic problem, of course. First place, yes, you want to have your own ideas and think carefully. But when you are criticized, don't get angry. Think about it. Talk pleasantly and talk with people. And if you can show them why you think this clearly, take time enough and show them why you think this and you have a good story, then that raises your reputation, you see. Because scientists like to understand. And if you have time enough, if you're in the same department as somebody and you can't have them disbelieving you, then you need to spend time enough and try to explain. And I think it's a matter of diplomacy just how you do that. But if you can show them that you do have the right idea and they were mistaken, wow, then your reputation goes way up, you see. And I can't give you any exact answer to that. It's a human question, a human problem that you've got to treat in a particular case, in a particular way.
Questions, especially from the young people. any of the students have questions? Okay, not all. Yes, please.
You told us that it's very important that different people collaborate and contribute to the field. But sometimes nowadays you get often the impression that there's a lot of competition, so you better watch your mouth, whom you're telling a story, or, you know, it's like that when you said you make a contribution, you have a good idea, and then you just have to be worried that somebody takes it and takes it as their own idea. So
yeah.
How can you solve this problem?
Yeah, the question is, to what extent should you talk with people when they might maybe use your ideas and so on? They all have similar ideas and the competition. Well, in the first place, I think it's very valuable to science as a whole that we be open and talk with people openly. That trading back and forth of ideas is a very important phenomenon. It's very important that you treat other people fairly. If it's their idea, you want to recognize that, and hopefully they would recognize it. What's your idea? And you do need to watch that. In some cases, brand new ideas, nobody else is all that interested in, such as when we first started the maser, you see. In the case of the laser, when we were writing a paper on how the laser would work, in the case of it was very different. In the case of the maser, I didn't bother to publish anything about how it might work. I just went to work on it. Everybody came in and saw it, and I didn't bother. I waited until we had it working before I made any publication. In the case of the laser, I knew, of course, there'd be lots of competition, and if we said anything, then other people would jump in and try to write something about it, and so on. So I decided, well, we better write a paper on the theoretical possibility rather than trying to do it. It'd take a couple of years to try to do it, so we write a paper on the theoretical possibility. So that's covered, and that's our idea, and then other people can contribute, which they did. And they contributed very importantly, and let's say Ted Maimon actually built the first laser. So there are many different aspects, and I think most physicists you can trust reasonably, most scientists you can trust reasonably to be reasonable, and you want to be reasonable too, but unfortunately not all of them, and you have to use some judgment as to just how you handle this, but I think we ought to be just as open as we possibly can, because that's a great advantage to science, a great advantage to us, to be open and get criticisms and get other people's ideas. But then, if it's somebody else's idea, be sure they get the credit for it.
Okay. Well, Al? I'm younger than he is.
and you also drove me from the faculty club to the IQP using the GPS.
It always occurs to me that there is a certain similarity between the development of laser technology and development of computer technology. In the early days, people joked, as you know, that lasers were beautiful science, but what could anyone do with them? And in a certain sense, the same thing was true when computers were first developed. And in both cases, the development came because, in part, because the applications hadn't yet really been discovered. One didn't imagine students downloading music from computers in every dorm room. That was just out of the question at the time. So it didn't take very large capital expenditures to make the next step from good science into a widespread, widely useful technology. And I sometimes wonder, in the days before government started supporting this kind of development, they usually depended on rich dilettantes of one kind who would take a scientist under his wing, or the church would build cathedrals for reasons which is not for us to judge. But an example of a technology that may or may not be useful, I have no judgment on that, but which takes so much money to develop that nobody is really making intermediate steps, is, for example, fusion power. It's always been 20 years away, as far back as I remember, and it's now 20 years away. What, other than having emperors and empresses who decide to support these things, what can we do to at least take the good things that take large expenditures to develop and get them developed?
Mm-hmm.
If not, yeah. What's the right thing to do?
Well, you comment on computers, and I think there's a great deal of parallelism between many breakthroughs, a great deal of parallelism. But now you're talking about one which, in order to try it out, you've got to have a lot of money. Really, for that, you've got to convince somebody with money, and usually it's the government we try to convince. And that makes a kind of a hurdle. I agree. I don't have any special solution for it, except that the government does frequently put money into things. The problem is that it puts money into things about which everybody is convinced, or which a lot of people are convinced about. If you have a new idea and other people are not convinced about it, the government's not very likely to put the money in. And I think that's a real problem. And I think the big things that take a lot of money, but which are so original and so different and not many people take it seriously, those are going to have a hard time. And I don't have any solution other than to make a lot of money so you can afford to do it. but there are many happy accidents that come along, and for most things, I think for most of science, there is enough money to make some original tries and make some tests and so on. And that's happened to me one time after another. Actually, Hap Schultz, who worked for a chemical company, theoretical chemist, he wanted to get infrared radiation of some intensity and sharp frequencies to excite molecules in order to produce particular chemical reactions. And he sort of traveled all around the country looking for a laboratory that might do that. He came to see me and said, well, you know, I can give you $10,000 a year, which was a lot of money at that time, if you would work on this. And I said, well, I don't know. I'd like to get infrared radiation, but I don't know how to do it. Oh, well, too bad. So he went away and he looked at a lot of other labs. Finally, he came back and said, well, I like what you're doing and I'll just give you $10,000 anyhow. And that $10,000 was the way I got Art Schaller to come as a postdoc and the way I got Herb Seiger to help build the first MESA, you see. So the happy accidents that can occur. But I'm afraid I can't tell you, you know, how you solve this. If you need $1 billion, I would say the first thing is to look for something smaller to test it out.
Any questions from the front row? Front row has been very quiet today. Any questions from anybody? Oh, finally, Walter.
Well, it's really a question to Charlie to. To let us have the benefit of your extremely thoughtful experiences. There is, of course, a problem that we all are aware of. That's the information explosion and how to deal with this. And it's tied up with your suggestion. Well, it's good to be interdisciplinary. Well, that means you should look at all science, but you can't look at all science. So you have to manage this in some way. And we all do that in as best we can. How do you do it?
Well, I'm afraid I fail. I can't look at all the science. Well, of course, I think looking at other fields, just talking with friends and things like this will help. But I have moved around from one field to another. And in many cases is because I thought I could see something in this field that the people in the field didn't quite realize. So I could move into that field bringing some of my expertise but seeing something new there. That's the way generally I have moved from one subject to another and one field to another and found things that would be useful. But I by no means can we understand all of science, unfortunately. We want to understand what we can and try to have insight, talk with other people, and then do the best you can, pick out, well, now where can I do something that's interesting, that's good? And don't hesitate to try to explore something different, something new.
Move from field to field. And in fact, this morning he reminded me he even did administration for quite a while at MIT. I guess the provost.
So you've been given, you were asked to give advice to some young people in the audience. How about some of the older people? Maybe you can tell us how, you know, give us some advice on how to be so spectacularly active and grow older.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to get some advice from you. I'd like to get some advice from you. Well, I can give one simple answer. You know, the body is remarkably responsive. That's what biology is like, and what much of nature is like. You use something and it adjusts itself to that use. You use something and it adjusts itself. It regulates. The body is sort of self-regulating and responds to what you're doing. I would say, do the things you think are fun and interesting, and keep doing them, and then you can keep doing them, because the body will learn, adjust itself, and help you do that. Now, of course, you have to be lucky, too. I think I'm lucky to, you know, not had a heart attack somewhere or something like this. And nevertheless, I do think that doing things that you enjoy doing are of interest, and continue to do them, and so on. Continue to exercise. You know, the more you use the muscle, the stronger it's going to be. And the same thing is true of the mind. Same thing is true of the mind. People know that very well now. So use what you have, and the body responds remarkably, and we'll tend to keep you going, I think.
On that note, let's close the call. I'm going to take Professor Towns to tea and cookies. Anybody who wants to talk to Charlie can come.